Psalm 55 is where we are. Before we begin the study, I'm going to show you some pictures. I usually don't use PowerPoint on Wednesday night, but I was so excited about this illustration that I decided to use it. Now, I know you can't see it real well because of the light, but there is a picture on the screen behind me of a man standing in front of a door. The man in the picture, you can barely see him. Let me enlarge it. It's grainy. But you see a man in front of a door. He's wearing a white sweater, hand in his pocket, looks kind of relaxed. The man's name is Theodore Malgorne. I don't know how you say it in French, but we're going to go with Malgorne. It's a favorite picture of mine, and it doesn't seem all that impressive. Just a man standing in front of a door. In fact, 5 years ago, Becca and I went on a tour to celebrate her graduation from high school, and we're walking around Paris just looking for really cool doors. Those doors, you know, aren't typical like you're going to buy at Home Depot. So it looks like, you know, it's just a man in front of a door, kind of like the images that we took of some cool doors in Europe. This one's different. Does anybody know what makes this door so special? Anybody have a guess? Well, the picture was taken by a man named Jean Guicard, and he was taking a picture from a helicopter. And here's this man, so at ease and at peace, but the rest of the picture shows that he's actually standing in front of a lighthouse, and a storm is raging around him. And I've always admired this picture, even when I was still in high school. I'd walk through the mall and they would have these poster stores with that image on it. Here this man is being protected from a watery grave only by this lighthouse. And the story is that he actually had seen or heard the helicopter, so he stepped out to see what was going on. He looked up at the helicopter, and the man was taking pictures of this lighthouse, and he just happened at the right moment to get this picture and a few in succession. And then, as the succession of picture continues, the water kind of sweeps around, and he had to make a very hasty retreat back inside the building. Although there was chaos all around him, he was calmed because he's surrounded by this mighty bulwark, a place of safety. All right, so we move from a picture of ease and comfort and everything looks placid. And it's beautiful by itself, I guess. But when you see the rest of the picture, it's stunning. That's Psalm 55. Psalm 55 is home to one of my favorite verses in the scriptures. Psalm 55 is home to a verse that often is quoted, or again, as we often say, printed on a greeting card, maybe put on a plaque and hung on the wall. I love Psalm 55:22. What an encouraging verse. Let's jump ahead to Psalm 55:22. Cast your burden on the Lord, and He will sustain you. He will never permit the righteous to be moved. I memorized it in the King James Version, so it says He will never suffer the righteous to be moved. He won't allow it. He won't permit it. Cast your burden on the Lord. He'll sustain you. He'll secure you, and He won't allow you to be moved. I've quoted that verse for much of my life, and there's kind of a New Testament equivalent, especially that first line, cast your burden on the Lord. What does that remind you of? Anybody? Yeah, 1 Peter 5:7, casting all your care upon Him because He cares for you. So you don't need to be bearing all these burdens yourself. You roll them off of your shoulder onto His. He's very capable to manage that. So 1 Peter 5:7 kind of gives you a New Testament equivalent to this beautiful text. So if I were to just take my hands to my Bible and kind of box in that verse, it's beautiful. So I can look at it kind of the way we looked at this picture. By itself, Psalm 55:22 is nice. But when we zoom out and see the entirety of the picture, the rest of the psalm is this raging storm. When David says, cast your burden on the Lord and he'll sustain you, he's not writing this thinking of, you know, lying out in green pastures. And he's not, you know, looking up at the stars like in Psalm 8. He is surrounded by a tumultuous sea. And in the middle of that, he's going to say, cast your burden on the Lord. So see if you don't see that we go from this window to a beautiful storm and a beautiful protection from the storm when we read the entirety of Psalm 55. Let's read it together. Psalm 55. The heading says, to the choir master with stringed instruments, a maskil of David. Give ear to my prayer, O God, and hide not yourself from my plea for mercy. Attend to me and answer me. I am restless in my complaint, and I moan because of the noise of the enemy, because of the oppression of the wicked, for they drop trouble upon me. And in anger, they bear a grudge against me. My heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death have fallen upon me. Fear and trembling come upon me, and horror overwhelms me. And I say, oh, that I had wings like a dove. I would fly away and be at rest. Yes, I would wander far away. I would lodge in the wilderness, Selah. I would hurry to find a shelter from the raging wind and tempest. Destroy, O Lord, divide their tongues, for I see violence and strife in the city. Day and night they go around it, on its walls, and iniquity and trouble are within it. Ruin is in its midst. Oppression and fraud do not depart from its marketplace. For it is not an enemy who taunts me. Then I could bear it. It is not an adversary who deals insolently with me. Then I could hide from it. But it is you, a man, my equal, my companion, my familiar friend. We used to take sweet counsel together. Within God's house, we walked in the throng. Let death steal over them. Let them go down to Sheol alive. For evil is in their dwelling place and in their heart. But I call to God, and the Lord will save me. Evening and morning and at noon, I utter my complaint and moan. And he hears my voice. He redeems my soul in safety from the battle that I wage, for many are arrayed against me. God will give ear and humble them. He who is enthroned from of old, Selah, because they do not change and do not fear God. My companion stretched out his hand against his friends. He violated his covenant. His speech was smooth as butter, yet war was in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet they were drawn swords. Cast your burden on the Lord, and he will sustain you. He will never permit the righteous to be moved. But you, O God, will cast them down into the pit of destruction. Men of blood and treachery shall not live out half their days, but I will trust in you. That is beautiful. I said a few weeks ago how much I enjoyed, I think Psalm 38 and 39. Just the beauty of the writing, the power of the imagery. Psalm 55 might be my favorite, at least for a while. That was beautiful. I mean, I almost tear up just reading it. The anguish that he pours out is so intense. And then the language that he uses is so beautiful. All right. I wish I could read and understand it in Hebrew. I took enough Hebrew to be useless. But even in English, that was beautiful. I wish Dan Totten were here just to enjoy, like, hey, Dan, just come and take us through this like a poem, because it's gorgeous. And again, like I said, the hope we see in the word that we, in the verse that we kind of cut out, we take out of context. The verse itself is beautiful, but when you see what's happening in David's soul and all around him, verse 22 just is staggering to me. Often we'll ask you kind of the tone or the mood of a particular psalm. And this one, he says several times that he is groaning, that he is moaning. You know, he is raw. He's so hurt. And you can almost hear his voice crack when he comes to the part in verse 12. It's almost like this was hard for him to write. For it is not an enemy who taunts me. Then I could bear it. It is not an adversary who deals insolently with me. Then I could hide from him. I would expect that. But it is you. And then he gives these four descriptions. A man. My equal, my companion, my familiar friend. And then he remembers their relationship together. We used to take sweet counsel together within God's house. Powerful, powerful imagery. Beautiful writing. This is so sad. And it's not him just saying that he's fleeing from the enemies. This is David writing with a broken heart. There's a lot of talk in here about hearing. About he's crying out. The very first thing he says is, give ear to my prayer, O God. And I wondered at that. You know, you could just say, just hear my prayer. But he makes it more vivid. Everything about this is so poetic. Give me your ear. Lean into me. Ironically, tonight, several of you are saying things and I'm like, I can't quite hear. My right ear is useless. So I need to kind of lean in. And David says, give me your ear. Lean into me. Hear the oppressors. Hear my moans. Hear my groans. And then eventually says, and the Lord hears me. He answers me. It's all beautiful. And then you have these ironies. The whole thing is so full of ironies. And we'll notice that as we walk through it. But for instance, we have seen times where David is in the wilderness and he's longing to be in Jerusalem. You know, when he longs to be in the temple, you know, even if I could just be like a bird that just sits there, I'm longing for the temple, but I'm in this place of solitude. This time, he talks about the city as a place of danger and iniquity and sin, and he wishes that his soul could fly like a bird, which is beautiful. I wish my soul could just fly. And where would I go? I would go out to the wilderness. I would love to be alone right now instead of surrounded by all these treacherous people, these enemies, these turncoats. Moving. For the first section, I am describing it this way. David was surrounded by foes without. We see it in verses 1 through 3, and then we're going to go ahead and jump ahead to verses 9 through 11. See, this is not one of those clean psalms where David is going to pour out his trouble, and then he prays, and then he lives happily ever after. All right, this is going to be another one of those where he says, I have all this trouble, and then I pray, and I still have all this trouble. And then I pray again, and that's kind of the rhythm of life. There's no easy answer here. So he's going to pour out his trouble, look to God, pour out his trouble, look to God, and it kind of goes back and forth. And we're going to look at it a little bit thematically. David was surrounded by foes without. Okay, the next point will be he was tormented by fears within. So when I say without and within, I mean his problems were outside around him. But then he admits that, man, I am having real troubles in my own soul as well. And you know, the only thing worse than people accusing and attacking and criticizing you is when it's happening in your own mind and conscience and you're beating yourself up. David says, I'm living that. So let's read verses 1-3 again. Give ear to my prayer, O God, and hide not yourself from my plea for mercy. Attend to me and answer me. I am restless. It's a powerful word. I'm restless in my complaint and I moan because of the noise of the enemy. All right, it's almost like, God, I feel like you can't hear me because my enemies are so loud. And it's ridiculous. Okay, God can hear everything. But he says, because of the noise of the enemy, because of the oppression of the wicked, for they drop trouble upon me, and in anger they bear a grudge against me. We'll look at verses 9-11 in just a moment, but powerfully, he asks God to take notice of his affliction. Give ear to my prayer. And then verse 1 almost sounds offensive. He doesn't just say, give me your ear. But then he says, hide not yourself from my plea for mercy. What do you mean, don't hide yourself? Why would David say to God, don't hide yourself when I'm begging you for mercy? Yeah, at first he says, God, it feels like you don't hear me. In fact, honestly, it feels a little worse than that. It feels like you're hiding from me. All right, you picture that there's a salesman or somebody that is coming down the street and you've seen that he's coming, and then you hear a knock at the door and you're like, don't answer it. All right, or this would be dishonest. But suppose I'm in my office and Brian Johns is walking up and I see him out my window and I tell Marnie, I'm not here. I would never do that to you. All right. But theoretically, David says, it's not only that I question if you hear me, I actually question if you're avoiding me. You're hiding yourself from me. Like you might hear me and just like, oh, not you again. He says, that's the way it feels when I pray to you. So then he says in verse 2, attend to me. Give me your attention is the idea. Answer me. So he has these four requests. Give ear, don't hide, attend to me, answer me. Now he gives four reasons for those requests. It starts in verse 3 with because. Because, I shouldn't skip over verse 2, when he just pours out his anguish, he says that I am restless in my complaint, I moan. Okay, so my heart is torn up. And then he says, here are the reasons for my request. I'm asking you to answer me because the noise of the enemy, again, kind of an ironic twist on give ear to me and attend to me, ignore the noise of the enemy. I'm asking you to help me because of the oppression of the wicked. And then verse 3, he says, at the second half of verse 3, he says, for they drop trouble upon me. Okay, they're all around me pressing in. But then he says, it's like they're dropping boulders on me. When I was a kid, one of the books that we had to read was Lord of the Flies. And, kind of a savage book anyway. But I remember this scene. I don't remember the details, but one boy is murdered by someone being like up on a cliff and looking down and dropping a great big stone on him. And David says, I feel like they're all around me, but then sometimes it feels like they're even above me and they're dropping bombs of trouble on me. And in anger, they bear a grudge against me. So he feels so miserable. And it's interesting. He's going to offer imprecatory prayer. So this is a psalm of lament and imprecation. And we've seen a lot of those. Has lament where he's grieving and groaning. And then it has imprecations where he says, God, punish them. But it seems that David is saying they are angry and bearing a grudge. And even when I ask for justice, I'm not doing it motivated by bitterness. I'm not holding a grudge. This is something that's sinful that David is describing. Now jump ahead to verses 9 through 11. We'll come back to 4 through 8. This is the imprecation. So first God asked, David asked God to take notice of his affliction. And then David asked God to destroy the destroyer. Do to them what they're trying to do to me. Verse 9. Destroy, O Lord, divide their tongues, for I see violence and strife in the city. Day and night they go around it on its walls, and iniquity and trouble are within it. Ruin is in its midst, oppression and fraud do not depart from its marketplace. Two requests for judgment. The first is easy to understand. It says destroy. The second one is divide their tongues. That's weird. Divide their tongues. Okay, it sounds like he's saying, you know, like clip of their tongues, almost like serpentine tongues. I don't think that's what he's saying. When David says divide their tongues, what could he be alluding to in biblical history? Babel. God, do you remember when men in their arrogance were opposing you and threatening you and trying to build something great against you, and you confused them? You divided their tongues. You caused their plans to become nonsense by dividing their tongues. And now he says, all these people scheming against me, would you come down and divide their tongues? Maybe not literally change their language, but would you would you bring disappointment to their planning? Would you bring failure to their scheming? Would you just mess them up and don't let them succeed? Then he gives all of these reasons. And again, you have just beautiful poetry here. In verse 9, he says, for I see violence and strife. You're going to have all these pairs of two. I see violence and strife. Verse 10, iniquity and trouble. Verse 11, oppression and fraud. Okay, and he almost sounds like Isaiah when Isaiah is saying what's happening in Israel. And he says there's all this wickedness in the city, there's oppression, and there's evil, and there's violence. He sounds like that. So he gives all these pairs, descriptions of violence. And then in the midst of that, he says it's happening everywhere and all the time. So he says, I see violence and strife in the city. This isn't the place where I'm longing to be. I actually want to be out of here in the wilderness. Verse 10, day and night. So incessantly, all the time. And then he says they go around it. They go around what? They go around the city. He says they're going around the city on its walls doing all kinds of iniquity and trouble. But then he says iniquity and trouble are within the city. Ruin is in its midst. Oppression and fraud do not depart from its marketplace. So he says this city is so given to sin. It's happening day and night. It's happening at the extremity of the city, at the walls. And then it's happening inside the city. And if you get right to the heart of the city, to the marketplace, every part of it is just wickedness everywhere you look. So all the time and in every place of the city, there's wickedness. And because of that, that's my justification for asking you to bring judgment on the wicked. Destroy them and bring their plans to nothing. So David is surrounded by foes without. And David is tormented by fears within. Go back between those sections. Look at verses 4 through 8. And again, it's hard to read this without almost tearing up. My heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death have fallen upon me. All right, that idea where something's, you know, they're heaping trouble. And now he says, I have trouble. It's the terror of death is falling on me. Fear and trembling come upon me. Horror overwhelms me. Okay, so here he goes through a description of anguish, terror of death, fear, trembling, and horror. That is misery. It's bad enough that I have enemies without, but I feel like, you know, sometimes we say people are battling their demons. And I don't mean literal demons, but he's got all of these thoughts and anxieties and frustrations. He's terrified. He's in horror. And this is a brave man. But he's absolutely beside himself, almost crazy with grief and anguish and anxiety. And then, you know, we have all this beauty in the whole psalm, and then it goes to another level. This is gorgeous. It's beautiful. And it's a prayer, a song to God. He says in verse 6, in the middle of all that distress, I say, oh, that I had wings like a dove. I would fly away and be at rest. Yes, I would wander far away. I would lodge in the wilderness. And again, there's a time when he's in the wilderness and he envies the birds that are harboring in the temple architecture up there. And now he's in the city saying, I wish I could be like a bird and get out of here. I would hurry to find a shelter from the raging wind and tempest. Beautiful imagery. I wish I had wings like a dove. And, you know, we think of, here we are. We're the pinnacle of God's creation. Truly. It's not pride. It's just biblical creation. You know, that God made all these other things, but he made man in his image. And we had a sermon a couple months ago, a month and a half ago, about, you know, how uniquely blessed and sacred human life is because we're made in the image of God. But here he says, you think of a dove and nobody even cares about it. I envy that thing. I envy the freedom that it could just, it doesn't have all the problems I have, and it could just fly away and not have to worry about it. And wouldn't that be nice? Now, I think you and I don't read this with as much poignancy as most people in history have. Because when David says, I wish I could just fly. I wish I could just fly away. We're like, yeah, that'd be cool, but how many of you have flown in your life? I mean, it's a common piece of life. Now, you don't have wings like a dove, but the idea of flight to you and me is rather normal. But for most of history, I told you a while back, I had read The Wright Brothers by David McCullough, amazing book. And the first human flight, like real controlled flight, happened in like 1904, something like that. It happened in the 20th century, yeah, basically 100 years ago. For thousands of years, the idea of a human flying was, you know, a fairy tale. David is talking about this like, obviously it's impossible. And he's not thinking of a flying machine. Okay, but to him, like, that kind of freedom would be hard to even imagine. Now, even those of us who can, you know, take Delta and fly anywhere we want, we still have to look at a simple bird and just marvel at the freedom it has, the genius of God to accomplish what he did in creation. All over the world, you have these animals that fly just effortlessly. But I still say, you know, 20th century, 21st century readers, this isn't as crazy to us as it might have been to those who have read it in the past. He longed for the freedom of the sky, especially in contrast with the raging wind and tempest. And that's where I think this image is so fitting. You have this man in the middle of the picture, and he's at ease, a hand in his pocket, but there's a raging tempest all around him. David says, I want to get away from all of this craziness. Verse 8, I would hurry to find a shelter from the raging wind and tempest. Now, the irony is, he's talking about finding a shelter, and right now he's not talking about God. You know, he's not really picturing God as a shelter. He really wants a shelter from his troubles, and he hasn't looked Godward yet. David's surrounded by foes without. He is tormented by fears within. What could be worse? Verse 12. David was brokenhearted by his false friends. Now we come to verse 12. It is not an enemy who taunts me. Then I could bear it. It is not an adversary who deals insolently with me. Then I could hide from him. But it is you, a man, my equal, my companion, my familiar friend. We used to take sweet counsel together. Within God's house, we walked in the throng. Here he is so burdened. And I think it was just last week we were talking about David feeling like he had been sold. You remember he had helped the area of Judah to escape from the Philistines, and then they tried to sell him to King Saul. And we use that illustration from history, the et tu, root, where Julius Caesar is saying, even you are selling me out? And this is David. Now, some scholars would say, man, that doesn't sound like David. You know, who would David feel that broken by their turning away from him? Well, he went through an experience with his son, Absalom, counselor, Ahithophel. This almost sounds, it didn't happen, I'm not rewriting scripture, but it almost sounds like the anguish that Jonathan turning on him would have inflicted on him. I mean, this hurts deep. And we really don't know what the experience is. And David is writing a hymn. He's writing a song for the people of God. And it's not necessary that he experienced all of this personally. There's some of this that he's writing for the people of God. And everyone knows some degree of feeling like your friends have turned on you. But he describes just the agony of this former friend. And again, it's beautiful writing. It is not an enemy. It's not a stranger. It is you. And then this, you know, you can almost sense somebody reading this and feeling so convicted. It is you, a man, my equal, my companion, my familiar friend. It seems like verse 13, he's gotten to the, you know, to the limit of why this hurts so much. But no, then you have verse 14. We used to take sweet counsel together. Within God's house. What's he saying there? We didn't just have friendship. We had fellowship over spiritual things, and we worshiped together. We prayed together. And now you've done this. And he weeps, he groans, he moans. Now, in verse 16, we have, but I call to God. That's good. Okay, so you're going to have verse 16 through 19 where there's faith. He calls to God, he gets relief. Okay, we'll get back to that, I promise. We're going to end there. But after he does that in verses 16 through 19, that's where he said, now it comes to verse 20. And remember that there's trouble and then there's prayer and faith, but then there's trouble again. Verse 19, he's going to come back to this idea. Excuse me, verse 20. After he calls out to God, verse 16 through 19, then in verse 20, he says, oh, this is still killing me. The prayer didn't take the pain away. You need to hear that. The prayer didn't remove the anguish. I'm not saying that prayer isn't powerful. I'm not denying Philippians 4, 6, and 7 that, you know, you let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God that passes all understanding will keep your heart and mind in Christ Jesus. That's true. Okay, but when you're really grieving over something, and then you pray, it doesn't mean that you're going to have just, you know, unremitting peace. You know, songs say that, you know. Oh, what peace we have from forfeit. Oh, what needless pain we bear, all because we do not care to think God prayer. If you would pray, you'd be at ease. You're definitely going to be better off when you pray. And that God can give you peace. But it still hurts. So he says in verse 20, which is kind of a continuation of verses 12 through 15, my companion stretched out his hand against his friends. He violated his covenant. This is so wrong. So unjust. And then verse 21, this is beautiful. It sounds like the book of Proverbs. His speech was smooth as butter. Yet war was in his heart. Let's do that again. His words were softer than oil. Yet they were drawn swords. What amazing contrast. It seemed so smooth, but it had such a sharp edge. It seemed like it was something that was for my good, but it actually was to cut me, to wound me, to destroy me. He's still grieving about it, even after his prayer. David asks in verse 15 for these false friends to be judged. And even this is ironic. He says in verse 15, let death steal over them. What's that? Let death steal over them. What do you mean steal over? What's the imagery? They don't see it coming. I want death to sneak up on them. Why is that poetic justice? Because they were sneaks. They were deceitful. They were treacherous. And now, God, I want their destruction to kind of fit the crime. So there's poetic justice and death sneaking up on them. And this is brutal, but it says, let them go down to Sheol alive. Sheol can be the grave or it can be hell. I think he's kind of saying, let them be buried alive. And you say, well, that doesn't make sense. Nobody buries someone alive. Right. And also, friends don't turn on you the way they did. Like, what they did was so unnatural, and their judgment should be in kind. Those are hard words. For evil is in their dwelling place and in their heart. Evil is in their home and in their heart. What they did wasn't out of character. You know, it's not like they were loyal, and then all of a sudden they turned on me. This was in their heart all along, and it finally revealed itself. Judas finally revealed himself. And again, you can't read that portion without at least having a foreshadowing of the suffering of Christ, where he's not only being hated by the wicked, but he's being forsaken by his friends, sold by one of his disciples, denied by one of his innermost disciples, crucified by his own countrymen. It reminds me of the anguish that we've talked about from John 1, 11 and 12, I think it is. He came unto his own, and what? His own received him not. So you have a hint of the anguish of Jesus in this. But you have such encouragement here. I've thought about our Wednesday nights, and I feel like for several months we've been studying songs that are full of lament and imprecation, and it doesn't feel very encouraging. Okay, but actually, it reminds me again of this image. There's this terrible storm, but there's a man in the middle of it that really is at peace. He really is secure. Now, you better go inside that door. But he's really safe. And you're going to see some beautiful expressions of faith here. Verses 1 and 2, remember, the whole psalm started with a prayer, not a complaint, but a prayer. Give ear to my prayer, O God. Hide not yourself from my plea for mercy. Attend to me and answer me. I'm restless in my complaint, and I'm moaning, I'm groaning, I'm weeping, but I'm calling out to you. Then verses 16 through 19, how beautiful is this? This is the piece in the middle of this picture. The point I put is David called out to God for salvation and safety. He says, but I call to God and the Lord will save me. Evening and morning and at noon I utter my complaint and moan, and he hears. He hears. The very first thing I said was, give ear to me. And he does. I'm still moaning, but I'm doing it all the time, and he's actually listening to me. Do you remember in verse 10 he said that day and night they go around sinning? And now he one-ups that, and he says, in my prayer, it's evening and morning, and at noon I'm calling out to God, and he hears me. He redeems my soul in safety from the battle that I wage, for many are arrayed against me. God will give ear. He will listen. He will listen to me, like I asked. He will listen to them. Remember verse 3, the noise of the enemy. God will give ear and humble them. Why would he do that? He who is enthroned from of old. Why would the fact that God is enthroned in heaven mean that he's going to hear me and judge the wicked? He can't help but bring justice. It's who he is. He's sovereign. He's enthroned. He's righteous. He's not going to sit by forever. He might wait, and his timing isn't your timing. But because he's enthroned in heaven, he will do righteously. He's going to settle the score. He's going to bring judgment on the wicked. And he's going to bring safety and deliverance for his own people. So David talks about this call to God. I love this. It says, verse 16, I call and he saves. Verse 17, I complain and moan and he hears me. Verse 18, he redeems my soul in safety from my many foes. Verse 19, he will hear me and he will humble them. There's all this cause and effect. I pray, he answers. I moan, he listens. You know, it reminds you of the people of Israel in Exodus, and they're calling out to God. And finally he says, my ear has been open to the suffering, the groaning of my people, and he delivers. And then we finally come to verse 22. And don't you see that when you read verse 22 by itself, it's beautiful. But when you read verse 22 after verses 1 through 21, this is precious. He says, cast your burden on the Lord. David is not praying anymore. He's appealing to us, and he's inviting us. Why are you living under all of this weight as if you can bear it yourself? Cast your burden on the Lord, casting all your cares on him because he cares for you. 1 Peter 5:7. And what will he do? He will sustain you. You feel like you're going to be crushed, but he sustains you. He will never permit the righteous to be moved, which is what I think initially took my thoughts to this picture. All right. There's all of this power that's coming toward him. There's torrents that want to wash him away. And this man is not moved. It's not because he's so strong. It's because he is surrounded by this great bulwark. He invites us to cast our burden on the Lord. He will sustain us. He will secure us. He'll give us safety in the midst of chaos. And then verse 23, I say, David rests that God will certainly help the righteous and judge the wicked. But you, O God, will cast them down. We've had a lot of that. They cast trouble at me. And now you will cast them down into the pit of destruction. We've already been there, to the grave Sheol. You will cast them down to the pit of destruction. Men of blood and treachery shall not live out half their days. There's irony. Men who are cutting others' lives short will be cut off themselves. The bloody will be bloodied. Again, you have poetic justice. And then you have this final resolve. That's why this whole psalm is such a work of art. And the very last thing he says is, "But I will trust in you." People hating me, friends forsaking me, my own fears are tormenting me. I will trust in you. And that's a beautiful depiction of faith. And again, it reminds me of the Father speaking to Christ saying, "I believe, help my unbelief." Like, I'm trying here. I'm holding on. I feel like I'm about to be washed away. I'm going to trust you. And faith is gritty. And it falters and it weakens. And I'm trusting God. Oh, those dirty rats are doing me wrong. Oh, trust God. And your whole life trajectory is probably not going to be spiritual growth like this until you get to heaven. It's gonna be like this. Isn't that your experience, that your life is just, you're walking by faith? No, you're not. Well, kind of. And you're all over the place. But at the very end, he says, based on everything that we've talked about, I will trust in you. Put my pen down. And that's the end. I love that. Psalm 55. I needed that. And maybe you did too. All right. Thank you, Lord, for this beautiful psalm. It's just beautiful language, beautiful imagery, but oh, the spiritual realities behind it are even more compelling to us. Thank you for giving it to us as a gift. And we don't need to be like a bird and fly away from our troubles. We're secure. You have us. You will uphold us and sustain us. You won't let us be moved. So help us trust in you more. Use this in the hearts of whoever especially needs it tonight. And I thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.